You are listening to the Global Security Podcast from Johns Hopkins University's Krieger School of Arts and Sciences, Advanced Academic Programs in Washington, D.C. Sitting across from me today is my friend Stephen Tankel. Stephen is an associate professor at the School of International Service up the road at American University. He's also a non-resident fellow at the Center for New American Security, and he's, in addition to that, previously served as a senior advisor in the Department of Defense. His previous book was Storming the World Stage, the story of Lashkar-e-Taiba, which came out from Oxford University Press in 2011. But today he's been kind enough to come by to chat with us about his new book, which is entitled With Us and Against Us, How America's Partners Help and Hinder the War on Terrorism, which is just out this year in 2018 from Columbia University Press. And we also both agreed that we should mention that he's a senior editor, in addition, as am I, by the way, at War on the Rocks. So it's a War on the Rocks staff meeting to talk about With Us and Against Us. Stephen, welcome.
Mark, thank you so much for having me here.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you. So just tell us, first off, how did you come to write this book?
Sure. So this actually started out as me trying to adapt my PhD dissertation, which had looked at you know, sort of how jihadist groups evolved. And I was particularly interested in, you know, the ways in which states informed the development of terrorist groups. And I was focused a lot on the threat. And then I went in to serve at DOD, at the Department of Defense, when I was about three quarters of the way done with the book. And I spent the year there, you know, working with various different partners, many of which were difficult in South and Central Asia. And it gave me a new appreciation for the constraints that policymakers face and for the importance that these countries play in terms of countering terrorism, but also the ways in which they can hurt our efforts as much as help them. Pakistan was a country that I worked on a lot, so it's sort of the prototypical partner in that regard. And I came out and I looked at the book that I had and I thought, you know, this is fine, but meh. You know, I think there's a better book to be written. And my sense is really also that the way in which I came to this, I think mirrors the ways in which policymakers look at the problem right now, which is to say, I started out writing a book that was very much about the threat. And I think that when we, as a government, do counterterrorism, we're very, very focused on the threat. Yeah. And we're far less focused on the cooperation that our partners are going to provide to help us to combat that threat. But those partners are absolutely critical. That cooperation is absolutely critical. And so, you know, I sort of saw my own evolution in terms of the book that I was writing as hopefully, you know, something that I want to encourage to be mirrored in the U.S. government in terms of putting more of a focus on what it is that we can get out of our partners, what we can expect from them. Because I think that will help us, you know, make better use of the cooperation that they are providing and mitigate in areas where they're not providing it.
So in your last chapter, which we'll discuss the substance of in more detail later, but in your last chapter, you've got policy prescriptions. And you were just telling me that in a lot of ways, this book was very much shaped by your experience at OSD. Do you view this as being something where sort of policy prescriptions sort of fell out the other side, or was this sort of a main purpose in writing this? What was your motivation for writing this book?
Sure. So I wanted to write a book that would help us do counterterrorism cooperation better and get me tenure, if I'm being completely honest.
Well, it succeeded in the latter, I guess. So good. Congratulations.
Yeah. You know, so I was trying to write a theoretically informed, rigorous, but also very policy relevant book. And I looked at this, the way I came into this was, we can't do most of what we want to do without partners. They're absolutely critical. The 9/11 Commission said, you know, the majority of international counterterrorism requires cooperation from other countries in one form or another. The 9/11 Commission was not wrong about that. There's no way that you get around the fact that you have to work with other countries. And I thought the Obama administration in particular was correct to put an emphasis on trying to work by with and through other countries, and both because I thought that it was important that we shared costs and risks, but also because I thought that that's how you make counterterrorism gains on the ground more sustainable, by giving local partners more ownership over the fight, and building their capacity and their capabilities to see this through over the longer term. But I also believed that, you know, we could tweak things. We couldn't make this perfect. A lot of these partners aren't perfect, but maybe we could get a better return on our investment. And that's what I was, that's sort of from a policy perspective, what I wanted to do was, how do we get a better return on our investment?
So what countries were you looking at before we get to some of the theory that you're building around this? But what countries did you examine?
Sure. So I looked at six countries in the Middle East, Africa, and South Asia: Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Mali, Egypt, and Algeria. All of those countries had jihadist groups on their soil at some point, both before and after 9/11, right? So that's a specific type of partner, as a country that has terrorist groups that you're trying to counter on their soil. Things obviously would be different if you were looking at countries that had never had an experience with a terrorist movement on their soil. And then I also thought it was important to not just have geographic spread, but to look at three countries that had long-standing relations with the United States, and three with whom the United States had formed security relationships really almost from scratch after 9/11 for the purposes of counterterrorism.
One of the things that I really love about this book is that you, in a lot of ways, avoid the perspective that's so common inside the Beltway, and to be frank, inside much of sort of policy-relevant academia, that, you know, everything's all about us. And you really, I think, have at the core of this the idea that the nature of the relationship between terrorist groups and, you know, the states in which they're operating, these six countries you just mentioned, is a really vital factor to understanding what those states do vis-a-vis counterterrorism, both domestically and with us. Do you want to sort of talk a little bit about that insight and how that turns out to matter, this terrorist-state relationship?
Sure, absolutely. So the nucleus of that was the initial book that I started to write, which was the relationship between jihadist groups or terrorist groups and the states where they're based. And then a lot of the rest of the book kind of got built around that. So that was always an important piece. It really clicked for me late in the game that what we were looking at was two different sets of dynamics in terms of how we should think about counterterrorism cooperation. And one is that sort of traditional set of alliance dynamics, right? The bilateral relationship between the United States and the partner. And that's going to matter a lot, but it's going to matter more in some areas than in others. And then the other relationship is that relationship between the partner and the target of cooperation. And that could be a group, but that target of cooperation is sometimes parts of an infrastructure. Right, so Saudi Arabia, it wasn't just that we wanted cooperation against Al-Qaeda, we wanted cooperation to counter terrorist threat financing. We wanted them to stop foreign fighters from going to other countries. And so there, you know, the population matters, the terrorist group matters, you know, the internal political dynamics of the partner matters, right? All of that comes into play. And I find that to be most important, depressingly so, when it comes to trying to get countries to conduct counterterrorism operations specifically. So not to provide us access, not to join a coalition externally, but to try to capture or kill the enemy, try to retake territory, try to stop terrorist threat financing, try to stop foreign fighters from going to other countries.
How about countering violent extremism, sort of the ideological angle?
Less of that. There's less of that.
Okay.
To the degree to which a partner views a terrorist group, right, or parts of that infrastructure as a threat and doesn't see it being useful, it's going to do those operations, regardless of what its relationship looks like with us. And even if it has a good relationship with us, if it doesn't view those actors as threatening and it views them as useful, right, or whatever instruments of statecraft we're going to bring to bear, it's not going to make as much of a dent as we want it to, right? And then, so I think we need to be very, very cognizant of the fact that we have agency, but there's also limits to the extent of that agency in terms of what we can accomplish.
So you make good use of the quad chart in this book. And you just touched on an aspect of this, but one of the interesting things you do is to chart the perceived threat posed by a particular terrorist group against a country, but also against the other axis of the usefulness of that terrorist group to another country. And I think a lot of us intuitively would think you'd either be in the bottom left, or you know, well, you'd be in one. There's really only two sort of quadrants that like the terrorist groups could be in. But is it possible? I think I saw some groups, you know, on charts here where they were sort of an asset to the country, but also sort of a threat to the country. That there's sort of an ambivalent relationship there. Help me understand that.
Absolutely. So for listeners out there, if you can sort of imagine a vertical line, right, and that's threat from low to high, and a horizontal line that's utility from let's go sort of left to right. Then in the upper left-hand quadrant, and by the way, this is if you want to go to www.steventankhell.com, these charts are up there, and you can view them there. But in the upper left-hand quadrant, right, where it's high threat, low utility, that's a belligerent relationship between the partner and the terrorist group, and you can expect them to conduct domestic counterterrorism operations and what have you. In the lower left-hand quadrant, where you'd have low threat, low utility, they're indifferent, right? Think about how Mali looked at the Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb from sort of, up until about 2008, 2009. It wasn't useful to the state, but it wasn't a threat to the state, so they just kind of ignored it. Bottom right-hand corner, high utility, low threat, you're talking about behavior by a state that enables or supports terrorism. Think about Pakistan, the way it views the Haqqanis and the Taliban, right? They're not attacking the Pakistani state, but they are useful to the Pakistani state. And then there is that fourth quadrant, right, which I called cooperative competition, where it's high threat, high utility, and my students insisted on calling frenemies.
Makes sense to me.
Right, it made sense to me too. I just, frenemies felt a little too, laissez-faire in the book. But really, that's what they were, was frenemies. And, if you think about how the Saudis, for example, viewed the terrorist infrastructure on their territory after Al-Qaeda launched its campaign there in 2003, 2000 through 2006, they saw threats from money flowing out the door. They saw threats from foreign fighters rolling out the door. But this was also still, right, enabled them to have domestic legitimacy by allowing fundraising or encouraging people to go fight on foreign fronts. It allowed them to project power. Think about how the Pakistanis viewed the, quote, good Tariqi Taliban Pakistan, right? Some of those tribal militias and militants in the federally administered tribal areas. High threat, potentially high utility, because they also fought across the border. Think about how the Saleh regime in Yemen viewed AQAP. Threat to the state, but also, at the very least, a mechanism for extracting assistance from the U.S. so you don't ever want to see it destroyed, right? And so it's this idea that states can have really nuanced relationships with these terrorist groups. And if we don't understand that, then we're going to misconstrue what we can get from them.
You then bring in a third dimension, the perceived threat that the terrorist group poses to the United States. And those don't always line up with how the local states see things.
No, it does not. And this, for me, was a really big point that I tried to get across in the book, which was that our policies tend to focus on shared threats. And if you look at some of the academic literature on alliances, it also tends to assume that shared threats will lead to cooperation, right? That terrorists are bad guys, and so therefore, even if we can't agree on other things, we should all be able to agree on cooperating against the bad guys.
Sounds so simple when you say it, but
I know.
But no.
I know. But the fact is that that's not the case. And as I just rolled through, in that other those other relationships I was talking about, you can have terrorists that are seen as kind of allies. But let's take cases where they are a shared threat. Even in those instances, things can be complicated, because it's not just whether or not you share a threat, it's how each side prioritizes that threat relative to other threats, and how you understand and perceive that threat. So I'll go back to the Saleh regime in Yemen, for example. The United States and the Yemeni government share a threat from AQAP, but by 2010, AQAP is the most dangerous terrorist group in the world, as far as the United States is concerned, and is a distant third in terms of concerns for the Saleh regime, which is much more concerned about the Houthi rebels and about the Harak movement, the separatist movement in the south. And so that's going to impair cooperation against AQAP, right? Saleh is worried about Ali Abdullah Saleh, the former and now dead president of Yemen. He's worried about AQAP, but not nearly as worried as he is about these other threats, right? So we need to understand those threat priorities. We also need to understand threat...
Sorry to interrupt there, but I mean, I guess also it's not just a question, presumably, correct me if you disagree here, of threat priorities for the local government, in this case Yemen, but I guess implicit in this is, you know, they've got limited resources, right? So they have to make difficult choices.
Yes, and in some cases where they do face other greater threats, and we're trying to give them security assistance, there's a potential for them to try to misuse that security assistance, right? Because they've got limited resources. And so it's sort of like, yeah, I want to make sure this terrorist threat never disappears entirely, even though it threatens me, because the assistance I have flowing in the door, even though I'm not supposed to use it against these other actors, I can sort of try
to reroute stuff, right? Yeah.
Or money, bullets, right? All of these things are fungible in that... I'm giving you ammunition, you know, or weapons that you can use against the terrorist group. That's going to free up other resources that you can use against another actor, even if you don't use my or America's resources against them. It gets even more complicated when the other greater threats to a country are partners or allies of the United States, right? So think about Pakistan. We may share a threat from Al-Qaeda and from the TTP, but Pakistan has other greater concerns, namely India and Afghanistan. Who are our two closest partners in the region? India and Afghanistan. You think that doesn't impair cooperation to a degree? Of course it does. And even in places where you've got a self-contained terrorist threat that everybody can agree is the top priority, like Egypt, how you perceive that threat is going to matter. So when we say jihadists, we think ISIS, we think Al-Qaeda, right? Those guys running around in the Sinai. The Egyptians think about those guys, and they also think about the Muslim Brotherhood. And so they run around arresting the Muslim Brotherhood, right? Which just makes more terrorists, you know, and engaging in human rights violations, which I would argue we should be opposed to just sort of, you know, on the face of it, on principle, and because that actually potentially makes things worse in the long run from a counterterrorism perspective. So all of these factors in terms of our partner threat perceptions matter. And if we're not empathetic, right, if we can't put ourselves in their shoes, then we're going to have really, I would say, you know, our expectations are going to be off, and we're not going to be able to plan accordingly.
Yeah. In that quadrant, in that part of the quad chart, where there's a terrorist group that the locals find low threat and low utility, it really doesn't loom large in their life in any way, but we may be very concerned about it. Are there cases, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but clearly, hypothetically, I'm wondering if there are any cases where they basically try and buy bennies from us by like, okay, fine, we'll take care of this, doesn't mean a thing to us, and now you owe us on something.
I mean, so, you know, I would argue that the Pakistanis weren't all that concerned about Al-Qaeda after 9/11.
Oh, really?
Right. You know, they were... Al-Qaeda came and took refuge in the federally administered tribal areas, and the Pakistanis conducted operations against the Pakistani... against Al-Qaeda because we were paying them a lot of money to do so. But those operations typically will not be comprehensive, and they won't be sustained. Right. If you're doing it in return for a incentive, then you get diminishing returns from that incentive over time.
Yeah. So that was a really interesting point. That was a thought that had never occurred to me before, where you talk about incentives and maybe disincentives, too. I don't actually recall. But how they sort of they erode over time.
Yeah.
Elaborate on that a little bit. How does that happen? What's that dynamic?
States will they're not going to want to expend a ton of blood and treasure. In return for security assistance or, you know, other types of tangible goods like that, right? If the United States had said to Pakistan, hey, we're willing to make you a treaty ally and go to war on your behalf against India,
that
might have been a different proposition, but to use a horrible Pentagon expression, that's a case where the juice is not worth the squeeze, right? I mean, what you're going to get out of that is not worth what you're going to put into it. And so you have these instances where, well, I'm giving you a certain amount of money or weapons or whatever, and once countries got them, they're pocketing them. And, you know, if the costs are rising for them, then you may get a case where they're like, okay, now we have, now the threat is real for us and we have to go to war against it. But you may also get a case where it's sort of like, look, this wasn't a threat for us before we started doing this because the United States asked us to. Maybe we can kind of negotiate our way out of it. The other thing I would say is in those instances where it's low threat, low utility for a country, even though you can't necessarily incentivize them to do stuff over the long term, if it's not a major threat for us, there is the potential to use that as an opportunity to try to build capacity in the right way. So I would look at Mali, for example, as a missed opportunity.
How so?
Well, we weren't so concerned about Salafi Group for Preaching in Combat, which ultimately comes AQIM in 2002-2003. We were more concerned that the Sahel may become a terrorist safe haven. But we weren't so concerned that we were going to put a lot of boots on the ground or do drone strikes or anything else, thank God. And instead of using what ended up to be almost 10 years to try to build strong institutions, get after corruption, improve rule of law, build a functional Ministry of Defense, right, professionalize the force, we essentially spun our wheels for almost 10 years building and rebuilding the same tactical CT units, right? So which then ultimately just collapsed once the state faces a real threat. And so my point is, you couldn't have necessarily gotten Mali to do the things you wanted to do in 2003-2004. But when its threat perceptions finally changed in 2009-2010, we're still 5 years away from building a good force, right? They do an assessment and they're like, hey, it's going to take us 5 years to build a solid force. And I'm kind of like, well, you've just had 5 years. But you weren't focused on it, right? Because it wasn't just low threat, low utility for Mali. It wasn't a big threat for us either. And so we just kind of, you know, threw money at the problem, but we didn't focus on making sure that that investment counted.
Gotcha. So in those cases where a country finds a terrorist group that the United States is concerned about to be high utility to them, and you mentioned a case with Pakistan, for instance, does the United States realistically have any hope of getting that country to do what we want in anything other than just a purely, notional kind of way? I mean, we are the world's sole remaining superpower, but
For the moment,
yeah, well, indeed. So do we have any hope, or do the local considerations basically realistically trump anything we can do to change their incentive structure?
I don't want to say we have no hope, right, because Gaddafi did ultimately move away from sponsoring terrorist organizations, and the Sudanese government in the 1990s moved away from that. But the issue with both Sudan and Libya was neither was an important partner at the time. So we labeled them state sponsors of terrorism, and then we just let them stew in that for a while. Mm-hmm. That's not as much of an option with a country like Pakistan, where we still need cooperation. And that's part of the problem, is that the normal coercive mechanisms that you would use against a state sponsor of terrorism are harder to deploy in cases where you're trying to work with that country, right? We still need access through Pakistan into Afghanistan. We still rely on it to a degree for intelligence cooperation. Our strong preference, even though legally we say that we have the rights to drop ordnance, is to have, you know, from a policy perspective, to have permission to do drone strikes there. So, right, for all of those reasons, it gets harder to use the hardest course of tools. What I've argued for is kind of more nuanced types of coercion. I'm going to have a bunch of recommendations at the end of the book, you know, that sort of enable us to escalate, to climb the coercion ladder, rather than going from wagging our finger and being upset to labeling a country a state sponsor of terrorism. And do I think that that's going to necessarily change that country's calculus? No, but I think it takes years for a country to change its calculus, if at all, right? And the Pakistanis, if we labeled them the state sponsor of terrorism, may decide, you know what? Screw it. We can, you know, we're not getting that much from America now anyway. We can ride this out. These are the instances where I think you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. You have to sort of optimize cooperation, which is, it sounds so bureaucratic and so unsatisfying. But, you know, these are really, really hard problems. And I think we do ourselves a disservice when we pretend that if we were just tougher or wanted it more, we would get the the solutions that we aspire to. The fact of the matter is we have limited control, and sometimes you sort of just have to make the best of a bad situation.
So you've been talking for the last couple of minutes about coercion. Do you mean that literally in the sense of sticks are more important here than carrots, or do you mean by coercion to include both those together? Or what role, if any, do carrots play in all of this?
I think incentives still matter, although I would ideally tweak both the way we do incentives and coercion. I'll give you a couple of examples.
Okay.
Right now, we give assistance, generally just we give assistance, right? And we're more concerned with either the influence that's going to buy or the capacity we're going to build, and sometimes we're not really clear which we're trying to do, right? So in this case, let's say we're trying to incentivize cooperation. We're trying to, right, to use assistance for influence. And then we don't get what we want. Our approach then is to say, well, we're going to put conditions on that assistance retroactively. But we're worried that if we actually enforce those conditions, right, that's going to hem in the executive. And so Congress then ends up building in waivers very often, which we've seen. And so then the executive branch uses those waivers. So now we've retroactively conditioned assistance, which we then didn't enforce. So we've harmed our credibility without changing our partner's behavior. So one of the things I've argued for in the book is a use of positive conditionality, where we sort of work with a partner up front on what it is that they're going to do. And we agree on metrics along the way and how the assistance is going to be used, and you get more or less depending on whether you meet those benchmarks. Another way to do this is to sort of do a Millennium Challenge Corporation style grants, where they put in a grant, and if they put in a grant proposal and they get a certain amount of assistance.
They being the other country.
The other country, okay. And if they sort of achieve what they want, then we can build on that, right? The idea is to truly incentivize good behavior, right? To do positive reinforcement. But to marry that where necessary with coercion that doesn't end the relationship, but also lets the partner know, hey, listen, we're willing to reward good behavior. We're also willing to punish bad behavior. So I'll give you another example. The Financial Action Task Force has a grading system, right? And the Financial Action Task Force, for folks who don't know, is in charge of sort of, its aim is to counter money laundering and counter terrorist threat financing. And if you were seen as not having the right measures and laws in place, then you could sort of end up on the gray list. And if you don't reform, then you can end up on the black list. And that can have negative ramifications for you in terms of investment. Well, the United States could invent a grading system, right, where the first step is we're going to declassify and release some intelligence. It embarrasses you publicly, you being the partner, and it lets you know we're beginning to build a case. And then the next step, now you're on the gray list, and a minor penalty comes with that. And then the next step is the blacklist, and a bigger penalty comes with that, but you're still not designated a state sponsor of terrorism, right? But you can see how you're trending in the wrong direction. But it gives you opportunities for self-reform, and it's much easier to move between those different sort of levels than it is once you're put on the state sponsor of terrorism list to get taken off.
Yeah.
Right? Once you're on there for years.
Yeah. So what if dealing with a terrorism problem requires a partner country to undertake really serious political or economic reforms? I mean, in some sense, what we've been talking about here is kind of, this is not the right term, it's sort of surface level stuff, but a lot of times these terrorism problems are really deeply rooted in, you know, the nature of that country and its governance, governmental system and political culture and all that. What happens then?
Sure. So I would make a couple points. First, I write in the book that the United States is now asking more of countries in these regions than it ever has before. And I think we need to remember that. During the Cold War, we were not asking dictatorial regimes to stop being dictatorial regimes, right? And we weren't necessarily asking them to wage war on their own citizens or expecting them to do so. And now we are. The problem is primarily external for us. It is internal for them. And so we were talking about the nature of their polities, right? The nature of their polities is now potentially a threat to us. But getting them to make these changes is enormously difficult. There are two different types of CVE, right, from a U.S. perspective. Listeners may be familiar with this.
Countering violent extremism.
We talk about CVE specific, which is to counter the ideology, to counter the narrative. And then we talk about CVE relevant, which is bigger changes in terms of rule of law, governance, broad socioeconomic reforms. If a country views terrorism as a threat, they may do the CVE specific stuff. It is very hard to get any of these countries to do the CVE relevant stuff. It takes decades. It threatens elites' hold on power, right? And we tend to not prioritize it. So the bottom line, unfortunately, is I'm very skeptical that we're going to have big success in those areas. That doesn't mean that I don't think we shouldn't push harder in some cases, if only because I think it's important to hold countries accountable when they engage in really bad behavior. And sometimes with a country like Egypt, for example, it's going to conduct domestic counterterrorism operations regardless of what we do.
Sure.
So we could hold the line a bit more on human rights. Where, again, this gets complicated is with a country like Egypt, we're also looking for access. We're looking for intelligence cooperation. These are instances where those instruments of statecraft, incentives, what have you, nature of the bilateral relationship, are most helpful. And so we have to balance how hard do we want to push you on governance and rule of law versus are you going to curtail the access that we receive. And these are trade-offs that we have to make. I think the problem that we've had up to this point is either we haven't faced up to the fact that we have to make these trade-offs. We've sort of said, well, we know there are trade-offs, but we have to have it all, so we're going to try to get it all. Or we've been too quick in many instances to preference short-term need for access or short-term desire for counterterrorism operations over some of those long-term areas of reform because they are much more uncertain. They are much more difficult to measure. It's much harder to get a country to do those things. But we've never really tried. So I'm skeptical, but I would also say there are instances where I think we perceive the costs to ourselves in terms of cooperation to actually be higher than they are, mm-hmm. and we could push our partners harder.
Well, I guess, some of what you've just been saying makes me a little pessimistic in that in this domain and in, frankly, most others, the United States government is not good at maintaining consistent focus and consistent policies over, the long term. I mean, you just said that reform, what did you say, CVE, relevant reform can sometimes be a matter of, decades. I mean, for crying out loud, 4 years is a ridiculously long planning horizon in Washington, D.C., usually unattainable. Decades is completely out of the question, whether on this, mm-hmm. I mean, I would argue, whether on this or frankly, just about anything else. So, yep.
So I would make a couple points there. One is, yeah, I 100% agree with you.
I wish it were not the case.
and our partners know it. Our partners know that they can wait us out. Right? They can kick the can down the road and there's going to be a change of administration or there's going to be, right, a policy shift and they're going to be able to, so they know that they can wait us out. So I'm also, unfortunately, a bit skeptical there. At the same time, I would point out that when we talk about some of these CVE relevant activities, this is new in terms of countering violent extremism. This is not new in terms of U.S. policy. The United States has been talking about wanting to promote governance and rule of law for a long time. We just didn't call it CVE. The question is whether we want to give priority to that or not, right? That's been a objective for a long time. It's just never been necessarily an objective that we prioritized. And in some of these countries, I think that's going to remain the case. And in others, it may be something where we could prioritize more. But this is also an instance where I think we could be doing a lot more to leverage our European allies.
How so?
Well, if you look at the European Union, they have, a lot of money to spend. They're not going to spend it on military assistance. They don't do military assistance. They don't do military interventions. They do state building. They do capacity building. They have a big focus on rule of law, a big focus on governance. We tend not to consider that counterterrorism, which is ridiculous to me, right? I've got another chart in the book where I sort of lay out in different columns what I see as all the different aspects of counterterrorism cooperation. If you look at our objectives, it's insane not to say that we don't view these types of reforms as CT, right? it's a question of working more closely with our European allies earlier on to synchronize what we're trying to do with what they're trying to do. And I think we do a poor job of that right now in places like Africa and the Middle East. We do a good job of telling one another what we are doing, but coordinating, I'm doing X and you're doing Y, and let's make sure that our two programs are deconflicted on the ground, is not the same as this is my planning, you know, document, and that's your planning document, and how do these mesh together?
Yeah.
You know, we do all this talk about quote-unquote burden sharing with our European allies. It's got to mean more than just we do less, you do more.
Given the fact that the top-level relations between the United States and its European allies are in a darker place than they've been for a very, very long time, is there realistically any hope for this kind of level of cooperation, which is a lower level, right, than you know, the grip and grins of the heads of government and defense ministers and all that? Is there any prospect of this kind of reform actually, or initiative actually taking place?
Sure. So I just spent a couple weeks in Europe doing some book talks and also having conversations with folks in Paris, Brussels, Berlin, London, and Oslo about these issues. And there's a mix of interest, right? Some countries are more forward-leaning on this, some are less so. And there's some interest in this within folks in Brussels and the EU as well. And in every stop, you know, I heard some variation of the following, which is, this is possibly the worst possible time for a project like this, and this is possibly the best and most important possible time for a project like this.
Okay, I can see the first argument. What's the second argument?
The second is that if we can't find ways to continue to work together and to show that we're working together, then we're going to be in an even worse place. And counterterrorism at the working level is still something that is going reasonably well. At the working level, the United States and European allies still work reasonably well together. And if we can build on that and find ways to leverage one another, then we can potentially have a good news story of, hey, look how the United States and its European allies are working even better, or are making efforts to work more closely together, synchronizing, right, military and non-military tools. And by the way, some of our European allies are prepared to put military skin in the game. I mean, the French certainly are in the Sahel. Then that's, you know, that we can sort of push back against that European allies do nothing, you know, narrative, and we can push back against the, you know, the narrative that the United States, you know, is you know, a, you know, just a bully, and that we can have, you know, we can find some, we can not only sort of do CT better, but CT can become a thing that we still do well together. CT being counterterrorism, for folks not familiar with the acronym. So, you know, I'm look, for those who have read the book, or hopefully those who will go read the book, you will see that I am, you know, not a, you know, wild-eyed optimist about any of these things. I don't look at this like we can build perfect cooperation. My question is, can we do a little bit better than we're doing right now? And do I think that there's space for us and our European allies at the working level to do a little bit better than we're doing right now? Yeah. I do. Not least because counterterrorism is no longer the top priority for the United States in terms of foreign policy. And so there's a recognition at the sort of middle level, policy level, that we're going to have to do some belt tightening. And we're going to have to rely on some other countries perhaps more than we did before. And we probably need, as we rethink how to make counterterrorism more effective and efficient, how we work with some of our closest allies to do that.
I think that makes very good sense. Last question I want to ask you, and we've talked a good bit about various of your policy recommendations. There are many more in the book. But there was one, I'll be honest, perhaps slightly subsidiary point in there, but that as a former intelligence officer really struck me. And this is getting back to the partner states that are that find terrorist groups on their territory, like the six examples that you really focus in on. What advice would you have for the intelligence analysts at CIA and NCTC and wherever all else who are writing to try and provide intelligence support to people like you used to be at in the Pentagon, who are working on CT policy and having to deal with our partners?
So first, take every time there's a request for analysis on the partner, take that opportunity to focus on partner motivations, not just capacity, right? I think there, and I think a lot of intelligence analysts want to do that and try to, and some do try to do that. I think often the fault lies with the policymaker, right? The policymaker looks at the threat and decides, here's the cooperation I want, here's the cooperation I need, what's the capacity that I have to build in order to get it? You intelligence analysts, tell me what's the partner's capacity and how am I gonna be able to, how am I gonna be able to fill it? What's their absorption capacity, right? What's the limit where they're gonna be overflowing? Help me get the Goldilocks amount right in terms of what to give them. And I think we're intelligence analysts, I think some already are doing and need to continue doing and others need to do is to push back and say, listen, the capacity matters, but look, here's all the other motivations that matter. Here's how giving this capacity is going to impact the political dynamics within the country. Here's what this assistance is or is not going to get you in terms of what you're asking for. The other thing I would say is that, on the intelligence side, I think there's been a good job of breaking down barriers between case officers and analysts, but we could still do more to break down barriers between people who do the functional counterterrorism side and people who do the regional side, right?
That's a long-standing problem. Right,
the country knowledge people and the target, functional knowledge people. I think we still need to do more there. And I think that carries over to the policy side as well. I spent a year working in the Office of Asian and Pacific Security Affairs and on different countries in South and Central Asia. And I can count on maybe one hand the amount of times that the folks in the building who did CT came to me and asked, hey, how's this policy that we're pursuing on the CT side going to impact what's happening right on the... in terms of the countries that you're working with, or how's, what should we anticipate the success or failure of this debate? And I think a lot of this goes ultimately to the policymakers. Policymakers need to ask their intelligence analysts for information about what they can expect from a partner, and then they need to heed that guidance.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Steven Tankel, the author of the just published With Us and Against Us, How America's Partners Help and Hinder the War on Terror, a book which everyone listening should immediately run out and buy. And Steven, thank you so much for coming by and sharing your wisdom with us.
Mark, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Global Security Podcast from Johns Hopkins University. For information about our part-time graduate programs, go online to advanced.jhu.edu. We hope you'll join us next time.